I'm Pastor Danielle, one of the pastors here at Spark Church. I'm so glad you're all here. Hey, Kwame. If you have any questions about Spark, just ask anybody in the row. But you can also come and talk to me anytime. And all of our information, not right during the service, just wait till after. Lose my train of thought. But please, I'd love to hang out, chat, hit me up for coffee, connect. We'd love to just get to know y'all. I just want to note, of course, all the thing that we all know, especially those of us Northern Californians who are well acquainted with fires in our area. I'm sure every one of us knows people who have lost homes and jobs and communities, north, south, all over. So here are just a couple of resources for you if you're looking for some good ways to connect. Spark Church historically has worked with World Vision whenever there's natural disasters, whether it's a tsunami or an earthquake or war. So if you are interested in connecting just directly with them, you can. Their local partner on the ground that they're working with right now in Los Angeles is the Dream Center LA. And Dream Center LA is looking, they're taking donations. They are looking for volunteers. So, and also, I just want to say so for those of you who don't know, my family's been evacuated 3 different times in Northern California because they live in Santa Rosa, and it's been very scary evacuations at least 2 of those times. So, and many of my high school childhood friends lost everything. Homes, their parents fled flames, like in nightgowns. And I'm going to tell you from my experience, what people need most is money. They don't need your old robe or old socks, okay? I know it's hard because you're like, I would like to put them to good use. We partner with Ridwell, which is a fantastic, wonderful recycling agency, and they'll find good uses for your old clothes. There's other places for that. They need money. They need gift cards. They need things. And they need them 2 to 3 months from now. A lot of people right now are jumping in and seeing the news and responding. And then when it's not in the news anymore, people forget and homes still aren't built and jobs still aren't had. There's whole, you know, huge communities that aren't just, you know, the rich and famous of LA. And even those people in those homes who we go, okay, well, they have some resources and it's devastating and emotionally horrible. And yet we know that eventually they'll be okay. There are people that worked for them that aren't okay, that no longer have jobs or staffing or housing themselves, who just worked at the coffee shop down the street in the community. And all of those people need support and help, okay? So these are some ways that you can engage, and I'm sure there's tons others. There's lists just specifically to focus on the Altadena community with racial justice work. All of it intersects, but here's at least 2 to start with, okay? Also, we know it's climate change. We know it's global warming. And if anybody wants to talk with you about this, I've got 10 words. You can explain what's happening in 10 words. It's real, it's us, it's bad. Experts agree, and there's hope. All right? And for those of you who've been around Spark for a while, we've been doing climate work, which we consider gospel justice work, for a long time. You can go to our gospel justice page and click on Creation Care to read more about global warming and climate and creation care needs. You can, if you're just entering into the conversation, I highly commend to you Saving Us by Catherine Hayhoe. She's a Christian and became a climate scientist because she's a Christian, because she knows it's how she needs to love her neighbors. She's amazing. We have a lot of resources on that Gospel Justice Creation Care page. If you don't have time to read the book, you just click on the picture of the book and read Kevin's notes on the book. It's better. It's better than Cliff Notes. Kevin's better than Cliff. So you can go through. Catherine Hayhoe also has a fantastic newsletter you can subscribe to, where she will give you like the difficult news and the good news all at once, and it's a really good balance. Her husband is an evangelical pastor in Texas, so she knows how to have these conversations with people who may not yet be convinced, and I highly recommend that book to you and others. So it's real, it's us, experts agree, it's bad, and there's hope, okay? And we'll continue to partner with communities that are impacted. Just one other side note, much of the world, the global poor, has been dealing with the effects of our global emissions when they've only contributed maybe 2% of the emissions for a very long time. So if you're talking about sub-Saharan Africa or Ivory Coast or Syria or low-lying Pacific Islands, et cetera, this is a long conversation. If if we're just waking up to it, it's because of our privilege. So I hope that we engage and do the Jesus thing. Yeah? Okay. Just, and pray. Y'all pray. Okay. So let's talk about gardens then. Yeah? So let's hang out. We're going to join in. We're doing this thing that I've been doing for many years. I, for like 14 years ago, built this roadster speed car to take everybody as fast as possible through all of the Hebrews, all of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation in 20 weeks. And now we're going to slow down and we're building more like a minivan for the whole family, okay? So this used to be our speedy challenge where within 1 week you would have read Genesis and started into Exodus, but here's our current plan. I'm going to take January and February to go through Genesis. Kevin has already told me it's too fast. So there's so much to cover in Genesis, and I agree with him. And if you want the very slow version, you can go back in Spark's archives when we started the church. I think it took us at least a year to get through Genesis. So you can go through some of that. But we're still going to go through it relatively quickly. And then we'll hit Exodus and Leviticus and Passover and Easter and Numbers and Deuteronomy. And once we get to June, summertime, when you have all that free summertime reading, we're going to start blasting through books a little bit faster, okay? Which you're going to be fine with because all the king's names rhyme, sound the same, you're already confused. No. We'll explain it all and we'll slow down a little bit. But if you're trying to read along, because this is the first year ever you're ever really going to try to read the Bible all together in community, you are not yet behind. We're starting in Genesis 1, chapter 1, verse 1 tonight. And I'm going to read the first chapter to you, so you're already going to be ahead by the end of tonight. Yeah? Sound good? Okay. If you want, Monday nights, we have a community gathering. It's online and in the room and on the Zoom. Even if you're not going to join that question, answer, detailed, all the things we can't cover on a Sunday, you might want to just join the group anyway because we're going to be listing resources and making those available within the group. Like, here's a cool map that you might enjoy. Here's some book recommendations. Here's the old devotion reading plan if you are trying to be very speedy so you can go through all that. Okay, ready? In the beginning, Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I just want to note that in the original Hebrew, the word "the" does not occur. So it's kind of like in beginning or a beginning. You can just hang with it. In the beginning sounds best in Hebrew, and I think it's the way we like it. So in the beginning, but it's not there. God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered over the face of the deep, while a wind from God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening and there was morning. It's supposed to be the first day. Sorry about that. And God said, "Let the waters in the sky be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. And God called the earth dry land, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants, yielding seed and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it," and it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning the third day. God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from night. Let them be signs for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from darkness. And God saw that it was good, and it was evening and it was morning the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, "Let earth bring forth every living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. And God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. Everybody's vegetarian at the very beginning. And every beast of the earth and every bird of the air and to everything that creeps to the earth and everything that has breath of life, I've given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. On the sixth day, God finished the work he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because God on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. The message tonight is called In the Beginning. Now, a lot of us, when we were first taught our Genesis story, we were taught it from the point of view of Answers in Genesis with Ken Ham. Anybody? Or how creation is a literal six-day thing. I remember when I was teaching fifth and sixth graders, there was a fifth grader at the back of the room, and he said, I don't believe in God. And I said, why not? And he said, because I believe in evolution. And I said, okay, you can believe in evolution, believe in God. He said, no, the last Sunday school teacher told me I couldn't. It wasn't that his science teacher said, you can't believe in evolution. You can't believe in God if you believe in evolution. It was a person at the church who had told him he couldn't have faith in God if he wanted to hold on to a science-based view of the creation he saw. Anybody else have any of those conflicts growing up? Anybody? Yeah? Okay. A lot of us have been taught to read Genesis like this, to start to open it up and go, okay, how did God do it in 24 hours? How did God do it in 6 days? How am I going to work this out? How am I going to defend a young earth narrative? How am I going to prove everybody that carbon dating is wrong? How am I going to prove that Adam and Eve frolicked with dinosaurs? And so we come at it from a very different perspective as we start to read. So when we've been reading, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, we start already with trying to figure out how to make this fit into our modern scientific worldview. I'm going to argue that Genesis was not written to do that at all, and that we are doing a disservice to the text when we try to do it. We're trying to make it do something it was never created to do. The Jewish Study Bible, in its opening introduction for Genesis, will say this, that the vehicle through which Genesis conveys its worldview is neither the theological tract, nor a rigorous philosophical proof, nor a confession of faith. The vehicle Genesis is using is narrative. It's story. And the theology must be inferred from stories, and the lived relationship with God takes precedence over abstract theology. I was chatting with a friend of mine, a Jewish friend of mine this week, and I was saying, tell me about, you know, your take on Genesis. And she was saying, you know, when we start reading Genesis, we're not really worried with what, you know, how God did it all. We're more concerned with how do we keep Shabbat? Like, that's the first thing that we're going to be worried about as that narrative starts is, oh, God kept Shabbat. We're supposed to keep Shabbat. So we have a lot of Shabbat conversations in Genesis 1. Which is a very different take, isn't it, for us? Now, those of us who think of stories as only for children, we misunderstand the thought world and the literary conventions of the ancient Near East. So the moment we're like, but a story is for a kid, a once upon a time fits for somebody else, we don't understand that that's not how their world worked. And we also condemn ourselves to miss the complexity and the sophistication of the stories of Genesis. So ancient Near Eastern literature and rabbinic midrash have a high tolerance for different versions of the same event. Right now, you're already going to know. Genesis is going to tell us two accounts of creation. We're doing one tonight. We'll do the other next week. Genesis is going to tell us two accounts of Abraham attempting to pass his wife off as a sister. Glad that story's told twice. It's going to tell us two accounts of God making a covenant with Abraham, two accounts of Jacob's name change to Israel. Now, remember last week, we talked about how the ancient Eastern world is different than our world, and that they don't think in a linear fashion, but they're very okay with cyclical or circular thinking. So here's what we know. These accounts, those two accounts I mentioned, those three different times it's done, are told as one long once upon a time. And this could not have happened if the existence of variation was seen as a serious defect, or if rigid consistency was deemed as essential to effective storytelling. Like, they wouldn't have passed down the story this way if it was a problem. So for the rabbis of Talmudic times, the exploration of this literary feature provided indispensable insight into the book, but also into the mind of God. So this was not a problem. In fact, it's not a bug, it's a feature. They like it. They love it. We read it and we're like, oh, this is really upsetting. You told the story two different ways. I need one story. Y'all have four gospels. Why does this bother you? It's okay, right? We can hang. All right. Now, so instead of doing this, Big Bang Theory, with the book of Genesis, we're going to do something different. What if Genesis is not written as a science book? What if it's not written as a history book? What if it's not written for any of those reasons at all? And when we try to use it for a science book or history book, it's like using a 747 as a paperweight. It will hold down paper, but that's not what it's meant to do, right? The 747 is created to help us fly, not to hold down paper. And using the book of Genesis as a science book or as a history book to defend six 24-hour periods does a disservice to the book, and it is also not what it's for. It's making the 747 hold down a paperweight. Now, I just have to credit Rabbi Judah Dardeck, who is a rabbi in Berkeley that Kevin and I ran to, I don't know, 2 decades ago, and he was like, this is why Genesis is written, and that's the image he used, and I loved it, so now I just say it's mine, but I'll still give him credit. He's like, Genesis is not supposed to be a paperweight, it's supposed to be an airplane. So, let's jump in. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 starts with 7 words. You can read the top, I'll read the bottom. I'm just joking. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, or beginning, in a beginning, created Elohim, God, the heavens and the earth, the land. 7 Hebrew words to start. Why 7? The poetry begins right at the beginning. What's 7 a picture of? Already we saw in just the order of creation, those 7 days, right? It's a picture of completeness and perfection and wholeness and holiness. So right away, the poem starts. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. And everybody starts to lean in and go, oh, this is beautiful. It doesn't start with, in a literal 24-hour period, within a 6-day period, God made it this way, right? It doesn't start that way. Instead, Genesis starts by telling us there was a beginning and there was a beginner who is pre-existent outside the bounds of time, because time is going to be created in the narrative. That's what Genesis wants you to start to know. There was a beginning of all that you see around you. It once didn't exist, and then the beginner, the creator, made it exist. And that's the world that Genesis is inviting us into. Genesis teaches us that God is a God of process. It was not fully formed immediately, right? Genesis doesn't start with everything you see was already there. It starts with the world being empty, with chaos, in Hebrew, tohu vavohu, with darkness and a foreboding abyss, a tahom that sits in front. That's how it starts. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered over the surface of the deep. So it starts with some sort of chaos. All of that there. And then, after darkness is covering over the face of the deep, the Spirit, or the wind, the ruach of God, hovered over the face of the waters. That's how the story begins. What are we supposed to learn from just those little bits? Over the waters, God's spirit, God's wind, ruach. Can you say ruach? Good job. That is a singular feminine noun. The word for our spirit, wind, is feminine, singular. And it hovers or trembles or flutters. It's in Hebrew, it's merachefet. It pulses, and it is a singular feminine verb. like a majestic bird hovering over its young in the nest. This word merachafet is also used in Deuteronomy 32:11 when it says that God carried Israel out like an eagle with its wings. Jeremiah 23:9, bones are trembling like they're merachafet under this awe of God. I want to just let you know that if you haven't yet seen it, please go on Via Media, Kevin's YouTube website, and watch Hover, because I can't get into all the details tonight, but you should watch it. It's wonderful, amazing. Look, it takes 7 minutes of my sermon, so I can't stop. But it's amazing.
All of us know what chaos is. Storms and earthquakes, droughts and floods.
I know you're going to want me to
fear,
keep going.
Anxiety, dread, depression, poverty, injustice, corruption, failed relationships, broken systems. These are all elements and effects of chaos. And the list goes on. And we all have experienced and lived through chaos. We've all both been victims and perpetrators of this chaos. For many of us, chaos is the default setting in our lives. We don't really know any other reality. We're just becoming experts at managing chaos. The author of the opening lines of the book of Genesis is very aware of this reality, which is why the book does not begin with perfection. It begins with chaos. Now the earth was formless and empty.
So you're going to need to go and watch the whole thing, okay? It's really good. So good. Many other videos too. But what we at least want to know, and I'm sorry I have to fix my fonts here, is at the dawn of creation, fluttering over the nest of her creation, at the same time as he, God, created all, they two in one are the first articulations of God in the scriptures. God is both female and male, and when God gets around to creating humans in the divine image, they will be female and male as God is. Feminine language occurs in the text repeated of God. This means that scholars advocating for inclusive and explicit feminine God language are not changing, but get this, restoring the text, and could be considered biblical literalists. This is a quote from Womanist Ridrash by Wilda Gaffney. This picture of God at the very beginning, God creator, singular Elohim, and then singular the creation word is singular masculine verbs, now shifts to God's wind and God's spirit, feminine singular, hovering over the chaos. And that's the beginning of our story. And when we point that out to you, it's not because we're a progressive, left-leaning church, which we aren't, by the way. We just love Jesus. But because we're trying to read the text and understand it as it's written thousands of years ago. Now, as God's wind, holy wind, hovers and spirit hovers over the surface of the waters, we immediately have an image of chaos. In the ancient Near Eastern world, and for the Israelites, waters represented chaos. It was a powerful image. Darkness, fear, unknown. Water imagery is featured again and again in Israel's story, in the Jesus story too. Why are they so amazed when he walks upon the waters and when he can calm the storm and the seas? Then the wind and the waters obey him. This imagery now is what God is hovering over. The ancient Hebrew conception of the universe kind of looks like this. They weren't flat earthers, okay, just so you know, but they kind of were like dome earthers. It's called a rakia in Hebrew. Did you ever look up at the dark sky when you were growing up and think, is that just a construction paper dome with pinpricks in it and a big light shining behind and I can see nobody, just me? Okay, so that is a lot of how they saw it, that God had put a firmament, a dome in the sky, and that there were windows in that dome that were leading to God in the heavens, and there were those waters and these waters, and then God was separating those. And the waters of the great deep of the sea were scary. That's where they would associate Sheol, the foundations of the earth, a frightening place where you're just not sure. Has anybody had the most ridiculous fear ever growing up. Did anyone? I had a swimming pool growing up, a doughboy my dad like built in our backyard. And once the sun set, I was like sure there was a shark in there. Now that's the most irrational fear ever. Anybody, right? It was just insane. I'm like, there's no shark here. I was in here 2 hours ago, daylight, everything's fine. But now I'm like, I think I gotta get out of this water. Like it's just a little bit scary. Nobody, I'm the only one. Okay. Yes? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I remember having a conversation at one point with a very little person who was like, but maybe there's a crocodile in here. And I'm like, those live in Florida. If there was a crocodile here, I would have had to like leave Florida, catch a taxi, get to the airport, have money, have a ticket, pass TSA, get on the plane, come all the way here, get off the plane, get into a taxi, say, my house, right? Like, and then like say, okay, come to that house and then get in the waters, right? And person was like, so there's a chance, right? So, you know, you just are a little bit worried because it's not a rational fear, but you know it's deep and there's mysteries down there and it's a little bit scary, isn't it? Anybody? Does this still happen to me sometimes? I have a good imagination. Okay. But here in our Genesis narrative, the creative, powerful words of God start to bring complexity and order and beauty from the amorphous, chaotic, empty wasteland of the chaos, the tohu vavohu, and the waters covering over the deep. God hovers over that chaos and starts to bring order and beauty out of it. Genesis is teaching us that God's presence in the midst of chaos is bigger than that, that it can bring light, order, goodness, and bring us back from the abyss. That God's very words create worlds. Because God will speak, Vayhi Or, let there be light, and there will be light. God just speaks it into existence, Vayhi Or, and then God sees that it is good, Ki Tov, it is Tov, it is good, beautiful light. Now, as Genesis continues then, what I love so much about it and what I never heard from any of the arguments about how old the earth was or how God did it or how the dinosaurs got there, I never heard anybody explain the literary beauty of this book, which is that as God creates day one and day two and day three, God is creating forms, containers, that then day four corresponds to day one. On day four, God creates things to put into day one. And day five, God creates things to put into day two. And day six, God creates things to put into day three. And day seven is rest. It's on its own. So each day has a partner. And what it tells me is that what God forms, God will fill. When God creates, God fills, and when God fills creation with purpose and breath, which we'll see in Genesis 2, when God creates the human and God breathes life, he forms the human and then breathes into the human, that God creates all of this with purpose and with life and with rest too. The rabbis actually had a conversation about that when they would say, well, if each day has a partner, then what is day seven? Day seven's all alone. This day of rest is all alone. And they said, oh, because the people of God are to be partnered with day seven. That they are to have partnership with rest. That is what God is modeling for us. Now we see in the middle of our story that God has made humankind. And God says, let us make the human in our image, in our likeness. And that's a really beautiful statement, and we love it so much. What does it mean? How did it ring in the ears of the ancient Near Eastern community? Well, those phrases for image and likeness were often used for kings, for the people that were going to be representing the divine gods, whether it's in Egypt or Babylon or the Syrian or Mesopotamian myths. Those images were only used for the kings. But Genesis uses it for every human you meet. Not just a king, not just royalty. In the book of Genesis, the idea of being made in the image and the likeness of the divine, of God, has become democratized. every person you meet, every single human being is made in the image and the likeness of God. All human beings are created in this way, and each one of us bears this stamp of royalty. Every person we meet. And it's so lovely when you walk around in your life, I'm just letting you know, and you start to frame every person this way. Because when they walk in the doors of, say, a church on a Sunday afternoon, you can sit there and go, oh, I am getting visited right now by royalty, by one made in the image and the likeness of God, by a creator who looked over them and said, just this and exactly this, and I want them so like this. And you walk out with my God breath into the world, showing everybody what the divine creator can look like. Now, Nahum Sarra, who's the author of the Genesis Commentary of Jewish Publication Society, says it this way, that the characterization of humans as in the image of God furnishes the added dimension of them being the symbol of God's presence on earth. While humans are not divine, their very existence bears witness to the activity of God in the life of the world. And this awareness inevitably entails an awesome responsibility that imposes a code of living that conforms with the consciousness of that fact. So just take that for a moment. If we are truly bearing the image and the likeness of God, the Creator in this world, the Creator God who speaks beauty and order into existence, who looks out over chaos and speaks into some shalom, and who looks at all of this and hovers over it and calls it good, how creates this beauty, and we are made in the image of likeness of God, what are we doing with God's creation right now? And how are we in any way bearing out that image? The truth is, if we are truly made in the image and likeness of God, then we have some responsibility. We have responsibility to be caretakers and to be like the Creator, who can bring forth order out of the chaos, not causing more chaos. But God looks at all of this and says, it is very good. Tov ma'od. Can you say tov ma'od? Tov ma'od. And God looks at all that God creates and says, very good. And I think Genesis wants you to know that. Genesis, the author of Genesis wants you to know that when God looks at you, God says, very good. Tov ma'od. Very good. Now, all of you, I've told you how to not read the Bible, but I'm going to give you permission to do a new thing with Genesis that maybe you haven't done before, and we're going to just tiptoe into some rabbinic interpretation, okay? Ready? Jesus did it, so I think it's good enough for us, yeah? All right. I'm reminding you that this is not to be scary and to not be like, this is the one way to view the text, that the rabbi said there are 70 faces to every text. Turn the gem again and again. You're going to discover maybe one or two or four tonight. You've got another 50, 60 to go, okay? Turn it over for everything is in it. We will never exhaust our interpretation of just Genesis 1, which is why Kevin said you're going too fast, okay? In Jewish sacred literature, midrash is the primary rabbinic term for exegesis. If you went to seminary, we didn't call it that, but if you went to Jewish seminary, you did. And from the biblical Hebrew, comes from the biblical verb, Hebrew verb, drash, which means to seek, and later it becomes specifically the term used to exegete something. It's still used very commonly today. Well, do some midrash, try to figure it out, search the text, right? My rabbi in Jerusalem said it this way, as my professor of rabbinic thought and literature, God doesn't waste ink. That's how he said it. It means that every time you look at the text, God did it on purpose, that the spaces in between are on purpose, in between the letters. Wilda Gaffney says it this way in her book, Womanist Midrash. Rabbinic exegesis is characterized by close reading of the biblical text. Midrash is mystical, imaginative, revelatory, and above all, religious. Midrash interprets not only the text before the reader, but also the text behind and beyond and in between the lines of the text. And in rabbinic thinking, each letter and the spaces between the letters are available for interpretive work. It is rarely comprehensive. It is occasionally contradictory, and it raises more questions than answers. That sounds like Genesis 1 to me. And Christian mystics from the desert mothers and fathers did it too. Okay? It's not only Jewish exegetical practice. So we're going to call it sanctified imagination. All right? If you don't like the Midrash word, we're jumping in with sanctified imagination. And here's what I think it would be beautiful for us to know about Genesis. What if the creation account was not written to tell us the science of how it happened, but was written to tell us that it happens? Not that God once ago, long time ago, did a work of creation, but that God is constantly about the work of creation in partnership with his creation. That the creation account was not written to cause arguments about how many days and hours God took to make this earth, but it was written to tell you that God does create. That it was made to tell us that we too are made in the image and the likeness of God, male and yes, female, and that no matter what your English translation says, and that God calls the creation good and very good, that God calls you good and very good. And as made in God's image and likeness, then we too are called to partner with God in creation, partner with God to bring forth light and goodness and shalom and order out of chaos. That is our vocational opportunity, our calling in this world. So when we watch the news, we go, okay, how am I going to bring light and hope and love to this moment? How am I going to bring some shalom, some peace and order to this chaos? And what if Genesis, this is the song of the Creator being sung over us, the creation? What if it's not a theology treaty? What if it's not a creed? What if it's not trying to argue science and history? What if it is simply God saying, let me sing over you this beautiful poem and song of creation. I want to sing it over you. Those of you who've been with us for a little while, you know Mark Iaconelli. He came to one of our last retreats, and he's been a friend of Spark for a long time. And in his book, Between the Listening and Telling, he tells this story. So you can go and read it. I heard him tell this story almost 11 years ago at a spiritual director program. He tells this story that's about Reverend Morton T. Kelsey, who's an Episcopal priest, a professor of Notre Dame, a poet, Jungian therapist. He authored more than 40 books on the spiritual life. He's since passed away. It's hard to find any pictures of him. He was like around in the 90s. And Mark Iaconelli tells this story about Reverend Kelsey. Reverend Kelsey was born premature. He was known as Blue Baby. His skin was transparent. His fingernails weren't quite in. He had a huge gash on the back of his head where they'd used forceps to try to take him out. And upon coming into this world, his mother rejected him immediately. Didn't want anything to do with him, pushed him aside. They forced her to nurse him. She did so with great reluctance. She despised him from his birth. And he tells this story of how his parents gave me just enough love to keep me alive and no more. And so they would bring him to his mother to nurse, and then she would push him away. They'd just put him in a shoebox right next to the fire, and they'd be surprised to find he was still alive in the morning. Now, when Mark met him, he was telling this story, that Morton had lived his life this way, and at some point he became so despairing of his existence that when he was a young adult, he decided to go up on a hill, and he took a weapon with him, and he was determined to end his life. And as he was there, prepared to leave this world, a song came to him. It was not a song heard through the ears. It was deeper than that. It was a song that came from the rocks and trees and stars and earth. It entered in my body from all directions. It was sort of a lullaby, a song of love and comfort and warmth. The song Morton hears that night reorders his sense of self. He's disoriented, he's confused and buoyed by what he's felt. He wonders if this was some kind of encounter with God. He has little religious understanding. The next day he walks into town, enters the first church he finds, an Episcopal church. And for the next year, under the care of the priest, Morton finds a way through the deep pain and rejection of his early childhood and goes on to graduate school and seminary. He becomes a husband, a father, a writer, a professor, and a spiritual teacher. God meets him in this moment while he's determined, in the midst of the chaos, to end it all. God comes in and sings this song. When he was in his late 70s, Morton received a letter from a woman named Clara, a 91-year-old retired librarian who had come across one of his books and wondered if he had ever lived in Palmerton, Pennsylvania, which was where he had grown up. And she said this to him, "When I was 14 years old, your parents hired me to take care of you. You were just an infant, but they placed you in my care, and together we lived in a detached cottage. I felt like I was the luckiest girl in town. Your parents provided a crib for you to sleep in, but unbeknownst to them, you never slept in that crib. You always slept next to me. Your parents rarely held you, but I loved to hold you constantly. And as you got older and I sang to you and told you stories, for 4 years, you were the center of my life. You were my best friend. I've been looking for you my whole life, Morton. Please come and see me." He got on the next flight with his wife and went to Pennsylvania to meet Clara. She had photos of herself holding Morton as a baby and a toddler. She shared with him the stories of his early childhood, what he ate, his favorite books and toys, and they loved each other immediately. Morton's wife, Barbara, said it was like a long-lost son returning to his mother. And when it was time to leave, we stood in the doorway exchanging goodbyes. When Clara leaned forward and hugged Morton, she placed her head on his chest, and she began to sing. It was a lullaby. It was a song she had sung to Morton as a baby. And he began to weep deeply. His wife didn't understand. And he tells her, do you know the song Clara sang, the lullaby she sang to me as a child? That was the same song that came to me in the mountains all those years ago when I was planning to end my life. Suddenly, in his late 70s, Morton had to change his life story. No longer was his the story about a child rejected and unloved, but now he would share in all his spiritual events about Clara, who deeply loved and cared for him as a mother should, who saw Morton's beauty and value despite his ailments and the rejection of his parents. His story changed because of the song that was sung over him from the very beginning of his time. He writes this, "I have found a loving, caring presence as I have listened to my dreams, listened to the silence in the middle of the night, and meditated on Scripture. In my deepest experience of worship and Eucharist, and in any time of quiet companionship with God, I have met a divine lover. I find this loving one is always there, desiring to draw me closer to love. Again and again, I hear gentle suggestions when I listen in the midst of troubles that my best way through them is by practicing unconditional love." This is the song the Creator is singing over you and me in Genesis 1. And maybe we've been listening to a different song. Maybe we've been walking around and saying, "I am not good. The Creator has not made me for any good purpose in this world." Maybe we've only been listening to the chaos and only keeping our eyes on the abyss. And we've forgotten that we have a God who hovers over chaos and brings forth shalom and order and light and love. Now, I know where I was when I heard this story, because just a couple weeks before I was at this conference, a dear little one had been placed into my arms for me to call mine. And she was sitting with Kevin at the local hotel while I would go to the spiritual direction retreat to finish my course of work. And I remember thinking, I don't know what will ever happen to this little one, but I'm determined to start to sing a song over her that she will never forget. And so I made up a song, and we still sing it every night. A song of love, of unconditional love and hope and purpose. And I sing it still. And I sang it then with the hope that no matter where this little one goes, they will know that the Creator of the universe, of microbes and of mountains, has sung over us a song of purpose and love and beauty. And I think that's what Genesis is wanting us to do. Auntie, so cute. What song, Mom? What song will you sing over the people you love? And what song do you hear the Creator singing over you? You are beloved. You are chosen. You are created with a purpose. You see, God's words create worlds. Let there be light. There was light. Our words do the same. What world will we create with the words that we use and we say with one another? What song is being sung over you? And will we tune in to the song the Creator sings? From the beginning, the beginner has called life and light into being. And you all of us together, we're part of that story. We are good. We are created with purpose. And we're part of something beautiful. And God looks at each one of us singing a beautiful song of creation. And in our beautiful, wonderful, scriptural, sanctified, midrashic imagination, what if Genesis 1 is a song? And a song that all creation is singing to constantly. That the trees are singing the song, that the creatures of the deep are singing the song, that the stars are singing the song, and we get to join in the chorus and say, yes, in the beginning, there was a beginner, and God called it good, and God looked at me and you and said, you are made in the image and the likeness of God, and you are of great, deep value just because of that. And God looks at you and says, good, beautiful, beloved, chosen, created. And that's the song I want to listen to. That's the song I want sung over me. And that's the song I want sung over you. That's the song I want to sing. I want to join in that chorus. So let's come to the table together. Let's sing a hymn. Let's join in a song with one another. And let's partake with our Creator God, who sets the table before us here every Sunday and every day and says, come, partake, dine with me. Anyone who's hungry, let them come and eat. Anyone who's thirsty, let them come and drink. This table has been set before you. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, take, eat. This is my body given for you, and do this in remembrance of me. And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. All are welcome at this table.